now ask our brother Brian Luke, and he's going to speak to the title, A Nail in a Sure Place.
Well, my dear brothers and sisters, we've got a whole chapter ahead of us and many, I suppose we would say, remarkably interesting verses. There weren't there, but many of them require a great deal of thought to really unravel what their significance is. And we haven't got any leeway tonight because this is my last class in Isaiah and we have to complete a chapter tonight. And as it happens, it's not only a chapter, but it's one of the most perhaps intriguing and matter-filled chapters that we've been dealing with. So I hope you've got your running shoes on, because we're going to have to really concentrate. And if you've got a pen and pencil at hand, then that will be a great help indeed. Now, fortunately, a little of the background was given to us by Brother Kevin a fortnight ago. And so that helps us somewhat to realise that these times are situated in the reign of Hezekiah, an inspirational king of great faith. And exactly the timing of Isaiah 22 is perhaps a little difficult to be dogmatic, but it's obvious that it comes before the investment of the city by Assyria, and yet not very far before that time. Isaiah enjoyed a very close collaboration with great King Hezekiah. And when we speak of King Hezekiah, I don't know what your understanding of him is, but he truly was one of the greatest of kings. So much so that in the prophecy of Isaiah, all of the messianic passages all have a primary application to him. And there's Isaiah, perhaps as no other book speaks of the different qualities and responsibilities and the career of our Lord Jesus Christ. And yet Hezekiah, more than anyone else, foreshadowed those very things that Christ would do. You know how he restored the temple and its services. He removed idolatry. He instituted a great Passover. He delivered the city of Jerusalem almost personally by his great faith. The remnant that was saved because of the king, because of the faith of the king, who in turn was cooperating with this wonderful prophet Isaiah. It's actually my conviction, my dear brothers and sisters, and just a slight a difference of Brother Kev's last class, it's my conviction that, in fact, the sickness that befell him, which was 15 years before he died, wasn't it, because he was given an extra 15 years, that actually occurred during the Assyrian siege of the city. Could I just show you why I think that? Would you mind just turning to chapter 37. In chapter 37 and verse 34, in the words that Isaiah said by way of answer to Hezekiah, we read in the final two magnificent verses, 34 and 35, by the way that he came, that is Assyria, Sennacherib, the great king of the Assyrians, by the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith Yahweh. For I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. Isn't that beautiful? David's a long time ago, isn't he? But he's been not forgotten by the great God of Chesed, of loving kindness, steadfast love. And so David is still before the eyes of his God because of the promise made. Now, that's the end of the prayer. The Assyrian is around the city. That's Isaiah's answer in the vortex of the matter. And in the next verse, the great horde of Assyrians is slain. Now have a look at chapter 38, verse 5. Isaiah is sick, about to die. And we read in verse 4, then came the word of Yahweh to Isaiah, saying, go and say to Hezekiah, thus saith Yahweh, the God of David thy father. David's not forgotten. I have heard thy prayer. This is a prayer for life from his sickness. I have seen thy tears. Behold, I will add unto thy days 15 years, and I will deliver thee and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city. If you just slide your eyes across the page, if your Bible's like mine, you go straight into verse 35, don't you? It's almost the same words. Chapter 38 clearly is in the hour of his sickness. The Assyrian is around the city. The crucial question is not only the health of the king, but also the salvation of the city. And so if that be the case, then it's reasonable to say that the sickness was at the time of the siege. Now, just coming down to verse 1 of chapter 38, we read that it says specifically, in those days was Hezekiah sick unto death. So I know there's difficulties chronologically, but to me that's pretty conclusive evidence that the two matters were really happening together. So if I have that kind of assumption just on that point in chapter 22, that might help you to understand why I think that way. Now if you come back to chapter 22, just to get some idea of what the chapter's about, verses 1 to 14, Isaiah's exhortation to the nonchalant inhabitants of the city, who seemed not to care, although this great calamity was coming upon them. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. End of verse 13. Seems to be the careless, godless attitude of so many of these lascivious inhabitants of Jerusalem. Now in the last, or the second half of the chapter, we have two interesting people brought before our attention. Verses 15 to 19, we have the case of Shebna, described as the treasurer or governor of the house. Shebna, whose name means to lead captive. To lead captive, that's a very significant name. And great calamity, a tragic and all-consuming descent falls upon Shebna. Verses 15 to 19. And then, verse 20 to 25, we have a very wonderful ascendancy to another man called Eliakim. Shebna up, or rather Shebna down, and Eliakim in his place. Verses 20 to 25. All right, so let's come back now to verse 1. Those two men, as Brother Thomas described, were obviously men of sign. Eliakim means God will set up, and the other one means he goes into captivity. So one falls and the other rises in his place. One a faithless man and the other one a true lover of the house of David and all it stood for. Now isn't it intriguing how the chapter opens? We found this time and again, haven't we, in Isaiah? Like chapter 21 and verse 1, the burden of the desert of the sea. That was rather intriguing. Isaiah 22 and verse 1 says, the burden of the valley of vision. Whatever does that mean? The burden of the valley of visions. If you switch over to verse 5, we see another reference there. Which is the day of trouble and of treading down and of perplexity by the Lord Yahweh of hosts in the valley of vision. Breaking down the walls and of crying to the mountains. Calamity, distress, despair has fallen upon the city. And there's a great host found in the valley of vision. Interesting, isn't it? What valley of vision do you think that might be?
Well, you probably remember the basic geography of Jerusalem can be described like this. There's one valley that comes down there like that, and there's another that sweeps and joins it like that. This is called the valley of the Sun Hinnom. And this one's called the Kedron Valley. There was another smaller valley just through here called the Tarapin Valley, but we need not be terribly concerned about that.
Obviously, this prophecy is focusing upon one of those valleys. Now, I believe that it's focusing upon the valley of the Son of Hinnom, and I'll show you why. In the second of Chronicles, chapter 28, there was a practice, a terrible practice, perpetrated by the kings of Israel and by others who followed their evil practice. Second of Chronicles 28 and verse 3. Moreover, he burnt incense, did Ahaz, who was the father of Hezekiah. He burnt incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom and burnt his children in the fire after the abominations of the heathen whom Yahweh had cast out before the children of Israel. Can you imagine anything more grotesque than that? Could you ever imagine that? You know, you've read about in the siege of Jerusalem how women vied with a child to cook it and eat it. But those people were in sheer and utter desperation, weren't they? To eat, to live. You perhaps vaguely might be able to understand that. But how do you understand verse 3? What kind of madness is this? And not only that, but it's the seed of David that are going into that fire, isn't it? Children of the royal seed. And because of that, doom was cast upon that valley. Quickly turn to Jeremiah 7. The last words of Jeremiah, very interesting prophecy indeed. But in Jeremiah 7, verse 32, we read, "Therefore behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that it shall no more be called Tophah," which means smiting or contempt, "nor the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they shall bury in Tophah till there be no place. And the carcasses of this people shall be meat for the fowls of the heaven and for the beasts of the earth, and none shall fray them away." So there is a meeting out of recompense to a king and his people, and Manasseh did the same, who took royal seed and others down here and offered them to the evil idols of the Ammonites, to Molech, who offered their children in that area. God says, "I will bring the carcasses of this people and they'll be heaped up in that area." It was, of course, also the place of the city's dump. The rubbish dump of the city was down there, and consequently there were fires burning in the valley of the son of Hinnom from time to time. If you turn now to two references in Isaiah, you'll see he refers again to the same thing. Jeremiah 30, there's no such story about the Tyropean Valley, for example. There's no such story about the Kidron Valley, but there is this story, often referred to by Isaiah and the other prophets. And that's why I'm sure that's the valley in mind. Isaiah 30, verse 30, "Yahweh shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lighting down of his arm with the indignation of his anger." 30 verse 30. "Yahweh shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lightning down of his arm with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones. For through the voice of Yahweh shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. And in every place where the ground staff shall pass, which Yahweh shall lay upon him, it shall be with tabrets and harps. And battles of shaking will he fight with it. For Tophah is ordained of old. Yea, for the king it is prepared. He hath made it deep and large. The pile thereof is of fire and much wood. The breath of Yahweh like a stream of brimstone doth kindle it." And it said that they would pour down the brimstone upon their own little child, as he was down there in a hole made in the earth. There was another form in which they had the child in the arms of Molech. And they made his belly a cauldron of fire, and the fire came out of his belly and destroyed that little creature. Just a terrible thing. So that then becomes, you see, verse 33, that area becomes a symbol of what God will do to those who conducted their wickedness as they did in Isaiah's day. Tophah is ordained of old. And of course that was in the valley of Hinnom, as you saw from the reference in Jeremiah 7, verse 32. Now, interestingly enough, you come through to chapter 66 of Isaiah, he has another reference, which is yet future. This place is going to have a future point of lesson to the inhabitants of the earth. So we read in Isaiah 66 and verse 22, "For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, saith Yahweh, so shall your seed and your name remain. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, that is from one month to another, and from one week to another, from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith Yahweh. And what shall they see? And they shall go forth and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against me. For their worm shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched, and they shall be an abhorring unto all flesh." So there's going to be left a symbol of the destruction which God will make in that place against those who rise up against his people. All right? Now you take the words of verse 24. "Their worm shall not die, neither their fire shall be quenched." Where do they appear? Heard of those, haven't you? Mark 9. Have a look quickly at Mark 9. This is the basis of what is in the New Testament Gehenna. the place becomes a symbol of eternal judgment. In Mark chapter 9 and verse 44, we have Jesus quoting from those very words. What's he speaking about? Verse 43. If thy hand offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go into Gehenna. Now that word Gehenna, translated hell, is the same as this expression here. It's simply abbreviated from Ge, and then the word for, which is the word for valley, Ben, and then the word for Hinnom. Ge Ben Hinnom. It was abbreviated to Gehenna. G for valley, then Ben for sun, and then Hinnom. That became abbreviated to Gehenna. See the idea? That's the word in the New Testament for the word hell. In most cases, not in every case. So this place, with its continuous burnings, and is used as a symbol by God of what he will do with those who sow their life to the flesh. And even in the future, that is going to be used as a place of teaching of God's ultimate judgment, eternal judgment, for those that resort to the ways of the flesh. All right? So there's some interesting things that come out of the concept of the valley of Gehenna, or the valley of vision. Now in Isaiah chapter 22, it probably had, as we can see from verse 5, it probably had a more direct sense, in that valley, it would seem, in particular, the Assyrian would come and collect. He couldn't really collect in this area because it's much more slowly as it comes up towards the Mount of Olives, much more inclined. But in this area, there could be a large encampment of people before you come to the lesser hills below that valley. So there's an interesting allusion, I'm sure. There's a sense of the actual area, verse 5, in which the Assyrian would be seen. The burden, therefore, of the valley of vision. Judgment's coming, Assyria's coming, and this is a message of warning. What aileth thee, verse 1? What aileth thee now, that thou art wholly gone up to the housetops? Is there something troubling you? Now, the sense of that's clear, isn't it? People normally went up onto the housetop when something was troubling them. They went up there, in other words, for reflection, meditation and prayer. In fact, if you remember back in Deuteronomy chapter 22, I think it is, there was a specific architectural injunction given to the people as to how they were to use the roof of their house. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 8. When thou buildest a new house, who would have expected to find this in the law? Can't you have the type of roof you'd like to have? No. When thou buildest a new house, then thou shalt make a battlement for thy roof. A battlement is a border around the outside, you see. That thou bring not blood upon thine house, if any man fall from thence. So the roof was a place that was used. And access to the roof was found by a staircase on the side of the house, independent of the house. So you could go into the house or you could go onto the roof. The stairs led up the side of the house, and you've seen, I'm sure, many photos of that. In fact, you can still see many homes in Israel, Arab homes like that today with their flat roofs. But you had to put a battlement around it because the family might be up there, see? You couldn't have little children on the roof, could you? With the prospect of them falling off. Mum would never relax. Come on. Well, in Acts chapter 10, verse 9, could never have the grandchildren home either. In Acts chapter 10, verse 9, we have a very lovely illustration of the way in which it was used properly. On the morrow, Acts chapter 9, 10 and verse 9, as they went on their journey and drew nigh unto the city, Peter went up upon the housetop to pray about the sixth hour, which is one of the hours of prayer, when the offering would be made, the evening offering would be made. So there's a very lovely concept. The house with its battlement around the edge, and a man went up there to think and reflect upon God in the time of prayer. But of course, it wasn't always used that way, was it? It was on that, in that very place where David's mind fell into a path of temptation, as affecting Bathsheba, as recorded in the 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 2. Now come back with me, my dear brothers and sisters, to a really intriguing little reference. Exodus chapter 30. In Exodus 30, it is speaking of the altar of incense. Oh, here we are, verse 3. Thou shalt overlay it with pure gold, the top thereof, the roof thereof, and the sides thereof round about, and the horns thereof, and thou shalt make unto it a crown of gold round about. Now there was a little symbol of the of every Israelite's home. It was the altar of incense. But the altar of incense didn't just have a flat top. It had a little rim that went around the top. And of course, in that vessel made by that rim was placed the incense. The interesting thing was that when it came to the house of every Israelite where prayer should be made, it had something of the same configuration. Every home was designed to be, rightly, a altar of incense. Well, what good was it putting incense in the temple if in the individual homes of Israel there was not an ascent to God of their prayers? All of our homes should be altars of incense, shouldn't they? As we're walking about our home, as we're doing our various duties, as we're in the kitchen with our children, as we're preparing the meal, as we're cleaning the house, all of those opportunities, we should be in communion with God and ensuring that what we're doing, we are doing because of our awareness of Him. And what a beautiful thing it was that right next door to the veil, there was something that was like every Israelite's house, flat top with a battlement around it, a little rim around it. And thus it was speaking by parable what Israel they should do in their own homes. All right, they're up on the housetops. What are they doing up there? They must be perplexed then, surely. Must be a time of calamity. What aileth thee that thou art wholly gone up? But my dear brethren and sisters, this is not consternation. This is sheer festivity. Thou that art full of stirs, a tumultuous city, a joyous city. Thy slain men are not slain with a sword, nor dead in battle. You see, it hasn't come yet, has it? So they're putting off the evil day, as though it will not really come upon them. Come upon the Gentiles, yes, but not upon them, not upon Jerusalem. No, never. So here is a city in a time of tremendous calamity that's got no more brains than Belshazzar in the night of his disdain, when he was sitting there in a drunken orgy and the Persians were coming up the river Euphrates, ready to take his city. And he's got 1,000 of his lords there, and Jerusalem's not much better. They're using their place of prayer as a place of revelry. And it's clear what the sense of verse 2 is. Slide again the eye across to verse 13. Behold, joy and gladness, slaying oxen and killing sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine. Let us eat, drink, and be merry. Let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we shall die. So you can see, can't you, the attitude of these people. They couldn't care less about what the prophet had said. They were going to have their good life. And that in a time, verse 12, when Yahweh had called for weeping, for mourning, for boldness, girding with sackcloth, for matters of reflection and concern. But these people would hear nothing of his warnings. And so, in vision, the prophet delivers to them what he sees. All thy rulers are fled together. But they never escaped. They were chased by the men with bows. They are bound by the archers. All that are found in thee are bound together, which have fled from far. Do you find that verse difficult? So it's going in several different directions. Perhaps this might help you. This is what I feel the sense of it is. All thy rulers are fled together. The Assyrian, when he came, never just came to Jerusalem. He went all through the countryside of Judah. You know, in Sennacherib's prison, he speaks of 40 cities that he took. He just picked them like they might pick apples. Just one city after another that was fenced was in poor state of repair. And so he came and just took them one after the other all over the place. And in that situation, the rulers of those cities just went in all different directions. But some inside that city would have done that too, wouldn't they? What would you have done, my dear brothers and sisters, if you were in that city? Hey? If a siege came to Adelaide, what do you do? Stay there or run? Tremendous decision that's faced people all through the years, faced all of Europe only just 50 years ago. That's war, my dear princes. They had to think about that. And we discussed this in the earlier chapters of Isaiah. You see, there were two passages at least, and there are others. But do you remember chapter 1 and verse 8 that I have continually stressed? That the sense of Jerusalem, chapter 1 verse 8, is that it was going to mean deliverance. And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Remember that? And the sense of that was that whilst Assyria would pluck 40 cities at a will, yet she would not take Jerusalem. That's a very important verse. Or, in the terms of chapter 8, when the Assyrian flood would spread over the land of Israel and Judah, it says in verse 8, he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over, he shall reach even to the neck, but he wouldn't get the head. So he would not drown the kingdom of Judah entirely, because it would come to the neck and it would stay there. So Jerusalem would be left as a little cottage in the garden field, as a besieged city. What would you do then? You live in Hebron. You live in one of the other cities of Judah. And you have Isaiah's prophecy, and it says Zion is left as a little cottage in the field. What are you going to do? Stay in Hebron? Stay in Bethlehem? If you have any faith in the word of the prophet, what you're going to do is go into Jerusalem, is it not? Because he says it'll come to the neck, but it won't take the head. But it does say in chapter 6, for example, in chapter 6 of Isaiah, verse 11, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, the land be utterly desolate. Never imagined that Assyria came to Judah and did not in fact reap terrible destruction. All right, the northern kingdom was taken by Assyria, but my word, Judah suffered tragically, and that right across the breadth of that land of Judah. But it was only the capital city that was left. And my dear brothers and sisters, you think of that in real life. You've got your own little kiddies and your family that you love so dearly. What advice are you going to give to them? As husband and wife, talk that over. What advice will you give to them? Will you put yourself inside that city or not? Root up everything that you've got and go to Jerusalem. And what are you going to do there? They got a spare house for you? Have to fit in with what you can. But you see, if you saw Isaiah there, and if you knew the quality of Hezekiah, and you knew that God was working him, there was only one place to go. That's just like today, isn't it? One place to go. This world's finished, but it doesn't know it. Let us eat, drink, and be merry. Who cares? Armageddon? Oh, who cares about the Bible? We can swear our heads off. We can write it in the papers. We can put it over the radio today. Filth, absolute filth that I've listened to in the last 2 days. And that's the average person of our society. Rapidly declining. One place to go. And that's where Isaiah lives. Our Isaiah. The salvation of Yahweh. And that's where we've got to go. And we've got to go there with determination. That's the place of life. And we're going to get in that city and stay in that city. And build the walls of that place. That was the issue that faced all of those people in the countryside. All thy rulers have fled together. You see, there would have been some in that city that would have said, well, I don't know. I think that Assyria is mighty powerful, and I've heard what they did to other lands. I'm getting out of this place. When she falls on this, it'll be a cauldron, as they will fight to the last minute, last drop of blood to get this place. No, let's get out into the city. Now, you see the interesting thing of that? That's the opposite of what Jesus said in his day, isn't it? Luke 21. You remember what he said? Those that are in the country, let them not flee into Jerusalem. See, you've got to know what the prophet says. If there's a time to get in Jerusalem, there's a time not to get in Jerusalem. It was no time to go into Jerusalem when the Romans came. And I wonder, my dear brothers and sisters, in that time, a little village out there would have seen on its own, like a little cottage out there, eh? And that family would have had to pick themselves up and go into Jerusalem. Or rather, sorry, the other way around. They would have been in that city. They would have thought they had big walls there. Surely they would have thought, we'll stay inside that city. there was a prophet some 30 years before, 35 years before. He said, look, when you see that, you get for the lick of your life out of this place. And they would have gone back to Isaiah's day and said, but in Isaiah's day, we were told to stay in the city. You see, could you believe the word of the new prophet, Jesus of Nazareth, and await the time of another Jerusalem? Isn't that interesting? So in this section, just to quickly show you how it goes on, in this section of Isaiah, which perhaps next year, if God wills, we'll go on to, just see how Jerusalem becomes such a place of significance and salvation, deliverance and strength. Look, like chapter 24, verse 25. Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion. Verse 2 of chapter 25. For thou hast made of a city a heap, of a defence city a ruin. That's the great cities of the Gentiles. Verse 3. Therefore shall the strong people glorify thee. The city of the terrible nations shall fear thee. In this mountain, verse 6, shall Yahweh of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines of the lees. Chapter 26, verse 1. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter therein. It was a time to enter, to find peace. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee. That is magnificent, absolutely magnificent. Really looking forward to getting to those chapters in Isaiah. They are beautiful, aren't they? So here we have in chapter 22, verse 3, people going the wrong way at this time, leaving the city because they thought that their circumstances would be better outside. But they never got away because they were caught by the archers who, skillful with their bows, of the men of Assyria, brought them to grief. All that are found in thee are bound together, which have fled from far. Now, what do you read into that? That's people going the other way, isn't it? All that are found in thee are bound together. Can you see what that's saying, my dear brothers and sisters? Some went that way, others went this way. And when they got into that city, they were bound together, you say, by a wall. Yes, but it's more than that, isn't it? Surely that's a reference to the faithful remnant, never mind what city of Judah they were, from right down Beersheba to right up to Bethel or wherever. Little families that made the right decision and they came to that city and they got there together and they had the same thing in common, the truth. That's what they had. And they said, we're going to fight this out together. We are bound together. We come into this city, not frivolously, but because we want life and to save our families. And Hezekiah was there. And Isaiah was there to inspire that remnant that came out. You see, that's the remnant that came out. Do you think when Assyria came down and Hezekiah was there and the people did what he said, he must have had them to a large degree in a sense of unity, mustn't he? And don't those earlier chapters of Isaiah speak of a remnant shall be saved? And isn't the sense of that they'll be a faithful remnant? It is. Where did they all come from? Were they all Jerusalem inhabitants before? No. Some of them came from far. And they got into that city and they were bound together in faith toward God, looking to Hezekiah, and he to Isaiah, and he unto Yahweh. And so they were bound together by a spirit of faith. One group going one way, the other coming into the city, believing what God had said. But my word, my dear brothers, is you have to admire a person that does that. And I feel that the truth is very much like that today. You have to admire people who are prepared to sacrifice for the issues of the truth and to direct their families, to direct their personal lives in ways which indicate that he will truly save a remnant. Let's make sure that brand of faith is with all of us. Don't go looking out. Don't go being affected by all the paraphernalia, the collapse of principle and decency, and of proper and right living that we see on every side today. It's horrifying, my dear brothers and sisters, to think where we are going. I mean, where the society as a whole is going. Let's hold on to our old-fashioned ways, because they were founded in days of faith. And if we do that and do it as a people bound together, then we will truly see the salvation of Zion. Therefore, said I, verse 4, look away from me. You know, I love this quality of Isaiah. We've noticed it a number of times, haven't we? He was not a person who could deliver his message without being touched. Look away from me. I will weep bitterly. Labour not to comfort me. People came and said, "What's wrong, old chap? Can we help you? Look, don't come near. Let me cry it out. I will weep bitterly because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people." Terrible, isn't it? He was not just beefing out a message and running off. It went right to his heart. Like chapter 21, verse 3. That was in respect to a heathen power, wasn't it? The fall of the Babylonians. "Therefore my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me." Like it when he cried out in an earlier time in chapter 2, verse 5. We found lots of these, actually. Anybody kept a little list of them? I have said to make a little list of these passages. The personal reflections of the prophet. Chapter 2 and verse 5. When he saw that picture of the house upon Zion's height, he said, "O house of Jacob, come ye and let us walk in the light of Yahweh." A lovely man, wasn't he? A really wonderful, stirring person who gave the message and, caught by the very spirit of it, then appealed to the people from his own feelings. "Labour not to comfort me," he said. "It's not a time of comfort, but a time of really getting down to the issues." And my word, my dear brothers and sisters, that's true for us, isn't it? Got this little bit of a retreat that we call our holidays from school. It's a good time to bind our children together, isn't it? Bind them together. And don't be worried about what the world will say about that. You have courage in your hand. You bind them together and rope their minds strongly in the things of God. And they will be able to stay when they go back to school and so on. Verse 5. Here's why he cried. This is what he had seen. Others couldn't see it. They could hear the words. They wouldn't see it. Boy, it is a day of trouble and of treading down and of perplexity. "By the Lord Yahweh of hosts in the valley of vision, breaking down the walls and of crying to the mountains." And the first part surely would be the effects of Assyria that he could see going through the land. And the encampment of that great host, a vicious company of people, in the valley of the son of Hinnom. And then he saw the people breaking down the walls. I don't think that's in reference to Assyria, because they didn't actually do that, did they? Who broke down the walls? It was, in fact, the people of Judah that did that. See verse 10. They needed to fortify the walls, so they broke down the walls of the houses of Jerusalem, that they might make the external wall stronger. And then it says, in the final phrase, "and of crying to the mountains." You know how that Solomon put all of those idols around the hills of Jerusalem. The 1 Kings 11 verse 7. And right up to Josiah's day, even after Hezekiah, right up to Josiah's day, they were still there. Reverence. The 2 Kings 23 and verse 6. So that's an amazing thing, isn't it? This people have been trained in idolatry for so long. When calamity came, they cried to the mountains, as though the idols upon the mountains would be able to help them. Now verse 6 has got its difficulties, perhaps. "And Elam bare the quiver with chariots of men and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield." Now we dealt with Elam in chapter 21, verse 2. And Elam was just east of Assyria and just northeast of Babylon. Got the picture? In the Zagros Mountains, before you got up onto the plateau that was Media and Persia, right? There's Elam on the slopes of those mountains. That's where it was. So in chapter 21 and verse 2, it's seen in the company of the Medes that came against Babylon. Here in chapter 22, verse 6, it's seen as involved in the confederacy of Assyria. That's not hard to understand, really, is it? It's very natural that Assyria would have brought troops from areas that were close to her that she had already conquered. Why, the British didn't they? They took those, apart from Australians and New Zealanders, they were probably archers, were they? What were those soldiers called that Britain took from the Punjab? Come on, Brother Frank, you'd know that's back in your era. The Gurkhas, yeah, I used to think it was a funny name. Wouldn't want to slip on one, would you? The Gurkhas, they were called, and they were said to be more loyal to the British Empire than the British were themselves. So, you know, we've seen equivalents to that type of thing in our day. It's not hard to see that they would have brought an already conquered neighbouring people with them. Now, it mentions Kerr. And we found a Kerr, didn't we, right down south and east of the Dead Sea. But that's not the people that are being referred to here. That was Kerr of Moab, remember? Kerr of Moab. But if you look in Amos chapter 1, you'll find there was another Kerr, and it was in Assyria. Amos 1 and verse 5. This is speaking of the Assyrian invasion and what it would do to different powers. And this is what it says it would do to Damascus, which was in Syria, already north of Israel. It says in verse 5, I will break also the bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitant from the plain of Aven, and him that holdeth the scepter from the house of Eden. And the people of Syria shall go into captivity unto Kerr, saith Yahweh. So Kerr must have been a leading city of Assyria, because that's the invading power. We'll take take Syrians to Assyria, to Kerr. So it's interesting, isn't it? So that seems to fit quite well. Chapter 9, verse 7 of Amos gives the same sense. We won't turn that up. And so we read in verse 7, and it shall come to pass that thy choicest valleys shall be full of chariots, and the horsemen shall set themselves in array at the gate. But it doesn't say they actually make an invasion of the city, does it? It doesn't actually say that. But the assault is found in that area. Now there's another reason for surmising that the general Assyrian encampment was down in Assyria, because it is a broad valley that comes down here. And I believe, therefore, that all of that works in together. That would be the natural way to come up from the south through those beautiful valleys, and you've got the Valley of Ephraim. Do you remember the Valley of Ephraim mentioned in the 2 Samuel 5? Well, that's just down here after that valley. It's a very beautiful valley. So that could well be a reference in verse 7 to that. Now, in verses 8 to 11, we have Judah's defences. Judah knew this was coming and had done quite a bit. In the following verses, verses 8 to 11, it tells us of the different ways in which it had sought to defend the city. Verse 8. He discovered the covering of Judah, and thou didst look in that day to the armour of the house of the forest. Now, there might be a number of things that are described by the covering of Judah, but it seems to be the sense of protection. In other words, the invader found the secret of Judah's defence. He discovered the covering of Judah. Now, there were a whole group of towns that were just north of Jerusalem, which were made cities of defence. Solomon made them that way. Rehoboam reinforced many of them. If you look in the 1 Kings chapter 13, you'll have a whole reference there. Sorry, it's the 2 Chronicles. Second Chronicles 11, verse 5, when the kingdom split up, Rehoboam, king of the south kingdom, realized that he had to defend himself from his northern brothers. Rehoboam dwelt in Jerusalem and built cities for defense in Judah. Built cities for defense in Judah. But some of those his father had already built, but you'll notice that there's a whole list of names there. And he fortified, verse 11, the strongholds and put captains in them and stores of victual and of oil. And in every several city he put shields and spears and made them exceeding strong, having Judah and Benjamin on his side. End of verse 10, in Benjamin fenced the cities. Now they were perhaps like a natural covering of Judah to protect the underlying areas of the kingdom. But then in a most peculiar reference it says, and thou didst look in that day to the armour of the house of the forest. Now, do you know what the house of the forest was? If you look in the 1 Kings, among the description of the buildings of Solomon, it tells us of this peculiar place. The 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 2. after he built his own house, it says in verse 2, he built also the house of the forest of Lebanon. The length thereof was 100 cubits, and the breadth thereof 50, and the height thereof 30, upon 4 rows of cedar pillars, with cedar beams upon the pillars. It must have been a beautiful place to behold prepared timber done with greatest expertise and breathing that lovely scent of the cedar, as though it had brought the mountains in all of their pristine glory right into the very centre of his city. A very beautiful house indeed. Well, in that house, 1 Kings chapter 10, in that house, Solomon appointed 500 special shields. 1 Kings 10, verse 16. King Solomon made 200 targets of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went to one target. And he made 300 shields of beaten gold. 3 pounds of gold went to one shield, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. And although we can't go into all of the details, but they are given for you voluminously in Brother John's notes, which I think you've all got a copy of, haven't you? What actually happened with these shields of gold was this, that when the king went up to the house of Yahweh, which was well up on its foundations, and his palace was down in the lower parts of the city, he ascended to the house of Yahweh, which was a glorious time, and such that the Queen of Sheba, when she saw that, there was no breath left in her. Do you remember how it says? She just saw the king going up. She was so absolutely overcome by all that she saw, the majesty of it, no breath left in her. And on flanking those, the king on either side, were these 500 men with their shields of gold, no doubt polished beautifully, shining in the sun, as the king was surrounded by his servants, a king, going up to be priest, as Solomon was at the beginning, in the opening of the temple and making the offerings. A king priest going from his place to the house of Yahweh, from his own house to the house of Yahweh, flanked by his servants, who bore shields of faith, shields of gold, as the Apostle Paul would describe them in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 14. The shield of faith. It was a glorious picture as the sun shone upon them, and a symbol to all of Israel of what truly defended them. It was their faith in God. But you see, they thought there was another covering. They had built up all those walls of all those cities. And well, they might. But that wasn't truly their covering, was it? And the tragedy was that in verse 8, when Assyria came, they would look in that day to the armour of the house of the forest. But would they find shields of gold? Somebody changed them. In the days of Rehoboam, they were changed. If you have a look in the 2nd of Chronicles, again. Sorry, it's not Chronicles record, it's in the King's record, I think, isn't it? In the 1st of Kings, Rehoboam, because of Shishak, the king of Egypt, in the 1st of Kings 14, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he wished to assuage his wrath. And so we read in verse 26, that he took away the treasures of the house of Yahweh, and the treasures of the king's house, he even took away all. And he took away all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. And King Rehoboam made in their stead brazen shields, like Goliath had. Shields that represented the flesh, and committed them unto the hands of the chief of the guard, which kept the door of the king's house. And you could polish those up as much as you like, but you'd never get them to shine like a shield of faith, would you? And so he took the faith that his fathers had had, and he replaced that with a reliance upon the flesh. And so at this time, in Isaiah's time, they look to the armour of the house of the forest. But you see, it's diminished glory. It's a glory that is depending upon the arm of faith, upon the arm of the flesh. And it would not defend them, verse 3, from the arrows of the archers that would bind them in death. All right, so there's a very interesting allusion, typical of the whole of this chapter, in which such a lot is said by so few verses. Verse 9. That was one defence, and that's tarnished. Verse 9. Ye have seen also the breaches of the city of David, that they are many. So they went to look around the walls of the city if they're going to be invaded, and they found, in fact, that the city was very broken down. That there were areas where the wall was quite crumbly and weak. That no doubt relates to Ahaz's diffidence. This listless character that could never get to and build that city. You may know it says of his day that Judah was made naked by that king. They were brought to a very great humility. And this foolish man, burning his children in the valley of Hinnom, hadn't given time and consideration to make that city strong and to build up those walls as they had been in time and place. Remember too that in the days of Uzziah there was an earthquake there. And no doubt it was from that time that those walls had been weakened. Ahaz had never done anything to improve the situation. So there was the second thing. The third thing was, and ye gathered together the waters of the lower pool. Now verse 11 goes on to say, ye made also a ditch between the two walls for the water of the old pool. But ye have not looked unto the maker thereof, neither had respect unto him that fashioned it long ago. Now you've got a copy of our insert. Has everybody got it? No, Andrew's got them, haven't you, Andrew? Thanks. If you've got one in your Bible, then perhaps use that one. I've got one, thanks. Now, if you turn to the back page of that, my dear brothers and sisters, that will illustrate in a stroke the wonder of Hezekiah's tunnel. You'll see on the right-hand side where the blue line begins, that's the spring Gihon. And it was down in this area here, say in that area there. So the water gate was, in the early times, about there, because that's where they went to do their water. Well, when there's a time of invasion, what are you going to do in the city? Because you need water in the city. So what they did, Ahaz himself had begun by digging a little trench that brought it in, back in, see, underneath this mountain which is here, which is Jerusalem. So he brought it in that way, and that's where it stayed. So some of the water went down into the valley, and some of the water came back into the upper pool. Get what I mean? The upper pool. So the wall then has to go round that, doesn't it? Water can be much good if it's inside the pool. So we've got the upper pool here, and the wall goes on the outside, and the spring acts on the outside. So what they're going to do is cover over the spring and allow the water to come back. But where to? Well, it would have to find its way through the mountain. And the remarkable thing was that a channel that was mostly 6 foot high, and before the days of modern instruments and so on, and that weighed a wavy course through this very hard rock, and for a passage of 1,800 feet, they brought it down to this area here. So what they had to do was change the wall of the city. Because by the time the water came this way, it was outside the walls, this is the valley, and so what they did, wall came like that before, now they put another fix like that. Now that's the sense that's given in the record, that they increased the extremity of the wall so that when the water came to the surface here, they could make the lower pool, which they called Siloam, and therefore the people could come in all the time and quite easily obtain the water. When they came to the upper pool, they came down through the rock and they had to drop a bucket down. It was hard work from time to receive it. If that's your only water supply, want to wash the dishes? Down to the tunnel. Put your bucket right down. Oh, but there's 500 people before me. Somebody needs a shower and so on. So it was exceedingly difficult. But if there was a continuous flow into this much larger pool down here, then the situation was manageable. You know what? When we were in Israel just in 1987, they've actually found this external wall here. They've found where it is. They found the foundations of it. They showed us, illustrated it. They also showed us other areas of that same Hezekiah wall, which was extended on the north.
They've now found Hezekiah's wall.
And they were able to show how there were little homes associated with that wall which were broken down, exactly like Isaiah says. They broke down the homes that they would be able to build the wall. In Isaiah chapter 22, verse 10, it says, "You have numbered the houses of Jerusalem, and the houses have you broken down to fortify the wall." No use having good sleep if your wall's all broken down on the outside, is it? Fix up your wall first, never think about your house after. Your defence is going to be critical. So they counted the number of homes and said, well, we've got 4,623 and we only need 4,531. So therefore we will break down 100 and so houses, you see, and we'll use the stone from that to build our wall. And now they've found the archaeological evidence of that. You go right down underneath the present Jerusalem and they'll show it all to you, illuminated down there. Wonderfully interesting. Just like fairyland, my dear brothers and sisters, to go down and see all that remarkable evidence. Your mind is absolutely astounded to see the accuracy of the things that were said. Well, what an incredible thing that was. Would you like to be chipping away at a piece of rock for month after month after month and wonder where the heck you're going? There's no beautiful electric light down there. You're just chipping away into the darkness of the stone. Now, I don't believe for a moment that was done by human skill alone, I believe. God has told him, doesn't he? How would men of that age have ever done it? They didn't have all of the instruments and so on that we've got today. Wouldn't be easy to do today. How did they do that? And as you can see from the diagram, it's a wavy course. You might have said, well, they'll go straight, but they didn't. They cut a course like that. I find that just remarkable. Nor were they off-centre. You know, the chisel almost hit each other as they were coming. They could hear the banging of each other, and lo and behold, the stone broke, and there they looked, and there they are. They could look at each other through the crack. What an incredible thing that was. Well, that was not, surely, by human ability, by the engineers of Hezekiah. And so in verse 11 it says, "But ye have not looked unto the maker thereof, neither had respect unto him that fashioned it long ago." You see, there was a greater story to all of those things, my dear brothers and sisters. This was Silo, a full saint. This was salvation. What is life? This is the story of life. Life would be found inside the city, not outside. Syria might be there, you might think you'll find salvation. No way. You'll find it inside with the one who sent. And Jesus sent the blind man, didn't he, down to the pool of Silo, saying that he was the one sent. He was the fulfillment of that. Later on, they call this spring of Gihon out here, they call it the Virgin's Fount. What an incredible thing to call it. Because it was one who was fashioned by God, curiously brought in the deepest parts of the earth, line upon line, as it were, by the divine embroiderer, and he came forth born of a virgin. It was the work of God. He was Emmanuel. He was God with us. He was the Word made flesh. And God provided him. And all of those things, my dear brothers and sisters, in the vortex of that time, were borne upon Israel that they would think upon them. Do you think if you were just going for the shopping, you would have been thinking about things like that? Eh? Where are we, my dear brothers and sisters, with all the information that we have and living so late in the peace? Do we think about things like that? Or is all the bits and pieces of life, the material, itsy-bitsy things, worry us so much that we don't get our mind onto the big things? You know, they were busy, they were chipping away. What are you going on about, Isaiah? We've got a job to do here. And you go, I can hear that, I can hear it. You hear that every day, because it's the thing that's in front of people's eyes that they so think is important. But the really grave things are things beyond that, the matters of faith, seen by the eye of faith. Got to be careful that our day isn't just filled up with a whole lot of insignificant trivia that don't really matter an iota. It's all boiled down. Getting our mind upon bigger things, higher things. Yes, it was a wonder. When they finally met each other and looked at each other through the crack in the wall, they had cause for incredible joy as they ran out either end and said to the people, "Lo, we found each other." And then were they to think that was just because of the brilliance of their engineers? Or because above them there was one who was directing both, binding them together by a fellow spirit, that they would find each other and be able to send down that little track so remarkably cut, they would be able to send the water of life and proud Sennacherib could boast all he liked outside, but inside they had life. And so God says, that's my blessing and privilege to you. All right, he called for weeping, verse 12, for baldness and girding with sackcloth, but they had revelry. And it was revealed, verse 14, in mine ears by Yahweh of hosts, surely this iniquity shall not be purged from you till you die, saith the Lord Yahweh of hosts. Pick up the sense. Tomorrow we die, you shall die, he says. See? Tomorrow we die, verse 13, you shall die indeed, because you will not have the deliverance that I offer. Well, in the midst of all that, comfortably ensconcing himself in the precincts of the temple, and as the head over the house was a man called Shebna. Verse 15. Go get thee unto this treasurer, even unto Shebna. Shebna means to lead captive. It was an ominous name, wasn't it? What hast thou here? And whom hast thou here? That thou hast hewed thee out a sepulchre here, as he that heweth him out a sepulchre on high, and that graveth an habitation for himself in a rock. So he's hewing him out a special place within the precincts of that temple, as though he's going to be there permanently. You could never take him out of his set position of governor of the house of Yahweh. Now, he was obviously also a priest. You see in verse 21 it says, I will clothe him with thy robe and strengthen him with thy girdle. The robe and the girdle of Shebna, those words are used of the priest's robes. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 1, you'll see that the head over the house was in fact always a priest. Pasha, the son of Immer, the priest, who was also chief governor in the house of Yahweh, heard that Jeremiah prophesied these things. So the fact that he was a priest is quite in agreement with the fact that he was head over the house. Will he therefore be able to engrave himself, as it were, in the very foundations of Jerusalem? In the foundations where God was carving out his way? Behold, verse 17, Yahweh will carry thee away with a mighty captivity, playing upon his name, Shebna. He will carry thee away with a mighty captivity and will surely cover thee. He will surely violently turn and toss thee like a ball into a large country. Therefore shalt thou die, and there the chariots of thy glory shall be the shame of thy Lord's house. So he must have got himself a real train, hadn't he? Like Absalom, see, with chariots and horses, and made himself a big person. This all in the very atmosphere of invasion. The Assyrians are coming. Look, city after city has fallen in Judah. What does this character care about it? He's sitting in there having a grand old time and heaping up his investments and heaping up his security in the very precincts of Jerusalem. And what does he care about all the little families out in Judah? About all the other inhabitants of Jerusalem? Not interested. But he didn't know what his name foretold. I will drive thee, verse 19, from thy station. And from thy state shall he pull thee down. So there's the decline of Shebna. Who will replace him? Verse 20. Shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. God will set up Eliakim. It's a beautiful name. God would support and strengthen this one. He's really a type of the Lord Jesus Christ, as Shebna is a type ultimately of those scribes and Pharisees who thought that they could etch themselves a permanence in the house of God. I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with thy robe. He will take your station and your state of verse 19. So I will clothe him with thy robe and strengthen him with thy girdle. And I will commit thy government into his hand. And he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Now quickly, my dear brothers and sisters, look at chapter 36 for the evidence of this fulfilled. Interestingly enough, in the day when Sennacherib came up and the message was taken to Isaiah, these men played a leading role. in Isaiah 36 and verse 3, "Then came forth unto him," to Rabshakeh on behalf of Sennacherib, "then came forth unto him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son," put alongside that to Isaiah 22 and verse 20, because that's the very man. "Then came forth unto him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son," and who was he? "Which was over the house," which was the very thing that Shebna was before, Isaiah 22 verse 15. And who's with him? Shebna, the scribe, the secretary. He's got a subordinate position to Eliakim. And the roles have been reversed. And God has given to Eliakim, a faithful man, that he will set up. He has given to him the robe of office. But you see in verse 21, my dear brothers and sisters, and we could spend just an hour on these last few verses, but instead of that we've got a minute or two. It says, "I will clothe him with thy robe and strengthen him with thy girdle, and I will commit thy government into his hand." What is he then? He's a king priest, isn't he? He has the robe of the priesthood, but he has the hallmark of royalty, the government. "I will commit thy government into his hand." Of whom does that make you think of? "The government shall be upon his shoulder." That's 9 verse 6, isn't it? Isaiah 9 verse 6. "And he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem." You know, Joseph was a father unto Pharaoh, wasn't he? Elijah and Elisha were called the father of Israel, right? "My father," he cried out, did Elisha, when Elijah was taken up. "My father, my father." So he's going to be a father, not in the sense of direct lineal descent, but because he's a caring, concerning person. And you know, again in chapter 9, we've got chapter 9 in one hand, and Isaiah chapter 9, among these other lovely titles of this ultimate son of David, it says that he will be the everlasting father, the father of the ages. Joseph put his hand across Egypt and succoured them and established them, saved their lives. So this son of David will put his hand towards all of the nations and he will save their lives. He shall be a father, however, particularly to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. You know, my dear brothers, there's something really touching in that, isn't it? He was a Shebna that had enormous responsibility. All he thought about was himself. You know, do you think it is a day of kindness and thoughtfulness? Do you really? When was the last time, my dear brothers and sisters, that we put ourselves out for our other brethren and sisters? When was the last time? You ever think about that young people whose attendance tonight and at our class is a credit to you, I might say, and a tremendous encouragement, I'd like to say that too. I really mean that. But do you think, when was the last time you put yourself out for somebody else? For the inhabitants of Jerusalem? Who cares a rap today in the world about doing anything for anybody? It's just total Shebna behaviour, isn't it? And because the age seems, therefore, to drive business like a hurly-burly, people feel as though that's sufficient, therefore, to justify themselves. It isn't, my dear brothers and sisters. That's only the getting of a present life, isn't it? What we need is a very much greater sense of Eliakim, who was a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He'd go around that city and he'd see the plight of dear old sister so-and-so with her six children that lost their dad last year, and he'd look after that family and see that people did it. And he'd see that they were being taught good things, faith-strengthening things, that they were coming behind the king, that they were listening to the words of Isaiah. A father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. We need a lot more of that, my dear brothers and sisters, because the age is cold. It's a cold, selfish age. And we can feel that in ourselves, can't we? Seeping into our own spirit and heart, because the world is like that. And yet this must be, my dear brothers and sisters, an ecclesia of care and interest in which our minds are towards the things of others and seeking their welfare. Well, this man, that was going to be a principal quality. Government will be given to a person like that, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Verse 22, "And the key of the house of David That was what the king took up when he went up to the ascent. It unlocked, as it were, the house of Yahweh. The house of David is the same as the spiritual house of Christ, isn't it? Jesus uses these terms in Revelation 3 verse 7 and says that he is the one that has the key of the house of David. It's not only just for the specific members of that house, but it's a house which brings in even Gentiles today that are spiritual children of David. He's got the key. So he shall open and none shall shut. And he shall shut and none shall open. None will be able to pervert his judgment or to call in question his giving of life or taking of life. Whether he opens or whether he shuts, he is the true door that openeth to his own sheep. Verse 23, and I will fasten him as a nail in a sure place. People never used to have cupboards in their kitchens. Can you imagine that? They just used to have a nail. It was a big peg that you'd put in the wall. And because the wall wasn't as strong as our walls, they'd have to put some mortar around it and fasten it into the wall. And they'd put various cloths from that. They might have different things in those cloths. Or baskets, you see. Couldn't imagine it. A kitchen without cupboards, could we, Dave? Excuse me. It's all got to be just so prim and proper, doesn't it? You know, thousands of cupboards and thousands of money spent on it all. It's all very beautiful. But not in those days. Simple kitchen, and yet upon these different nails, big nails, put into the wall, would so much be fastened. And that, with that figure of speech, he says, I will fasten him as a nail in a sure place. In other words, you'll be able to put a lot of weight upon him. The weight of government will be upon him and he'll bear it up, a sure nail. Put the weight upon him, he won't fail. And you know, that was Hezekiah in this day, wasn't it? Look at the pressure that was upon him. And in the midst of all of that, my dear brothers and sisters, in the midst of all of that, Hezekiah fell sick. And no doubt people thought there's the collapse of the nail that's holding us all up. But he wasn't. His faith, even in his human bodily weakness, prevailed. And God delivered that city. I will fasten him as a nail in a sure place, and he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house. See the contrast with verse 18? Shall be the shame of thy Lord's house. He shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house. He will grace the throne of David. And we're not speaking of Eliakim now, are we? Our minds have gone ahead of Eliakim. They've come to the one that God will truly set up, even his anointed son, and he will establish him with reliability and surety. As a matter of fact, the very word which is used there, a sure place, in verse 23, is the same as the sure mercies of David, of Isaiah 55 and verse 3. Or the, I will establish his throne, of 2 Samuel 7 verse 6. It's the same word, sure and established. He shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house. You know, I find that a great comfort, my dear brothers and sisters, living in a world like we do, don't you? Can you see Jerusalem's throne established? Can you? Do you believe that it will be? Do you believe that David's son will be upon that throne in Jerusalem? Do you believe that? Colossal thing to believe, isn't it? And all of the stuff that's in Jerusalem at the moment will be swept aside. All of that idolatry, all of that trading, all of those buildings of the apostasy and nunneries and monkeries and everything else that's there. You know, a hopeless hodgepodge of international interest. Swept aside. And David's son. He's got a hotel they call there today. King David Hotel, that's right. King David Hotel. How about that? And it's this modern, full of all the conveniences of his present life, you know. And all the rich people of the world dine out this King David Hotel. Oh, the savour's there. Savour of the food. There's no other savour there, my dear brothers and sisters. What we want to see is this. This stands for sound, faithful government. And it's a terrific thing to hold on to in the latter days, isn't it? That upon that very site there will be established because of the integrity of God and because he loved David and swore an oath to him that he would establish him there. And they will not only establish his own son there, my dear brothers, but that nail will draw all others, because he's not only the nail, but he's one with the key. He's got the key of hell and of the grave. And he'll unlock for all those loved ones that we've had in the past that have died in that faith. Whether they've been in Australia or England or America or in Europe or all through down through the years. Third world countries. He will establish that. And the world will rest on that nail. They shall hang upon him. See the terminology? They shall hang. Laying the weight. Can take the weight. Doesn't crumble. No elections. Doesn't change policies midships. They shall hang upon him all the glory of his Father's house. What a magnificent expression. Can you see that in the future? When, my dear brothers and sisters, David is established in that house of prayer for all nations, David's greatest son is there. Can you just imagine how the people will come to that place? And they'll come with their Bibles and they say, but it's always been here. And we will be there, my dear brothers and sisters. We will know that it's always been there. Can you imagine how our hearts would just bubble over for that? And perhaps if we've not made good, or we've not been baptised, if we've let the thing go too long, we knew it all our days, we knew it was right, and it came and we missed out because we left it go. Other things were said to be important. We'll be weeping and gnashing then, wouldn't it? With tremendous grief. Because foolishly we put other things that were not important in their place. But he goes on inexorably as the one that God has established and appointed. And those who are in there in that day will think of the time when they learnt that in their Sunday school. When they learned it in doing the readings. When they marked up 2 Samuel 7. And it will bubble over in their hearts as they see that God is indeed a God of truth. And he's established his king. David's son. Never forgot it. They slew him and put him away, but he was exalted and established by God. Taken out of the earth and established gloriously in Mount Zion. They shall hang upon him all the glory of his father's house. The story will all be told of David. The boy from Bethlehem and how the promises were made and how he sang the psalms. It will all come back. And you know, in that day, my dear princess, they won't have their newspapers, they won't have their weeklies, they won't have their radio, and they won't have their television, and thank God for that. Thank God for getting rid of a lot of that muck that comes into our homes and ruins our minds and takes us away from these things, does it not? My word, it does. The more we listen to all that stuff, the less we become people like Isaiah. The less we really believe, the more the crows, the more the cricket, the more all those other things enter into our heart and mind, the less, my dear brothers and sisters, these things burn in our minds. This is what God is going to do. And he's going to remember the little ones, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He's going to be a father. He who never had children, he'll be a father, all right. This is the one that found blind Bartimaeus. This is the one that found Zacchaeus, where no one else would. The offspring and the issue, all vessels of small quantity, means earthen vessels, vessels of little value. They're there, a widow with two mites, spent in God's service. They're all there, from the vessels of cups even to the vessels of flagons, large and small, rich and poor, the small of the earth. He remembers them all. He's a father to the two inhabitants of Jerusalem. Verse 25, in that day, saith the Yahweh of hosts, shall the nail that is fastened in the sure place be removed, be cut down and fall, and the burden that was upon it shall be cut off, for Yahweh hath spoken. Brother Thomas believed, my dear brothers and sisters, that it was a reference to the crucifixion of the Lord. I find that a little difficult. I really think myself that it fits better a turn upon Shebna and upon the Shebna class. For if Jesus can take these things forward into the New Testament and give them application, that becomes then those that oppose the Lord Jesus Christ. He comes into their office. And Jesus said, didn't he, your house is left unto you desolate and given to others, bringing forth the fruit thereof. And that's him and his people. It's the Shebna class that secured themselves in a sure place. And their nailing home is destroyed. And God diminishes them and cuts them off. And all that were hanging, leaning upon their strength, is allowed to fall and be cut off. For Yahweh hath spoken. And what he's appointed will stand at that day. You know, isn't the Bible a most remarkable thing? that that was said so long ago, and yet it's as powerful tonight as it was when Isaiah said it that day. Thank our Heavenly Father, my dear and sisters, for our Bible and for our Bible class together. Thank you.